From Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor and NPR, I'm Todd Mundt. Hello and welcome. Later this hour, we're going to talk about the mathematics of other cultures.
It is the mathematical ideas that they derive from their work, and we call this their ethnomathematics.
It might be weaving or a game or a special custom. Everyday life in other cultures produces math, and we'll talk with someone who has studied ethnomathematics a little later this hour. My guest right now is Laura Boroditsky. Professor Boroditsky has been studying some of the cognitive processes of the brain, and some of her latest research is into a question that maybe you've asked before or maybe you've thought of. Does someone who speaks a different language from you think in a way that's different from you? Does someone who reads words from left to right see the world in a different way from someone who reads right to left? She and other specialists have been studying how language shapes the way people think about concepts and time, and she's here to talk with me about that. If I spoke Mandarin and you spoke English, what might be the ways in which my ways of thinking would differ from yours?
Well, Mandarin and English differ in many different ways. One of the ways that we've investigated already in my lab is how Mandarin and English speakers think about time. So in Mandarin, speakers use both horizontal and vertical ways of talking about time. For example, to say the next month in Mandarin, you would just use the word for down. You'd say the down month. And to say the last month, you would use the word for up. You'd say the up month. And in English, we mostly use horizontal terms to talk about time. And we've looked at how English and Mandarin speakers think about time, and we found that Mandarin speakers actually tend to think about time vertically, and English speakers tend to think about time horizontally, just as language would predict.
Now, why is it that the Mandarin speakers will think vertically about time?
Well, in their language, vertical metaphors are used much more often than vertical metaphors are used in English, and so they tend to import vertical spatial information to think about time.
Time is one sense. Are there other senses in which people who speak different languages think differently?
Sure. Languages differ in all kinds of fascinating ways. For example, say you wanted to say something really simple like, the elephant ate the peanuts. In English, you have to include when the event happened. So you have to say ate instead of eat. In Mandarin, you wouldn't have to do that. You just say eat. In other languages, you have to include tense, so when the event happened, and you also have to include other information. For example, in Russian, which is my native language, you have to include the gender of the peanut eater. And you'd also have to include whether all of the peanuts were eaten or only some of them. In Turkish, you'd have to include whether you witnessed the peanut eating yourself or just heard about it from a friend. And these are all obligatory things that speakers of those languages always have to include in their sentences whenever they're describing past events.
How does that affect the mindset of the person who is delivering the information or hearing the information?
Well, we're just starting to investigate these issues. One of the things we're doing in my lab, for example, right now, is looking at how Turkish speakers remember the source of their information. So remembering where you got your information is incredibly important for, of course, judging how true or not true it is. And since Turkish speakers have to mark the source of their information a lot in language, we're wondering if they actually are much better at remembering where they got their information.
How do you conduct tests for that?
Well, we have simple memory measures. For example, we either show people pictures of things that they get to see themselves, or we get someone else to describe scenes for them. And then we test later how well they can remember which things they actually saw themselves and which things they got described for them. And then we can compare English and Turkish speakers to see how well each group can remember.
If languages are closely related, for instance, like the Romance languages, Spanish, French, and Italian, is there a greater similarity in how people who speak those languages think?
There may be, though we have been looking at some pretty closely related languages and still finding differences. For example, we took one rather silly way that languages differ in terms of grammatical gender. So in Romance languages, as well as languages like Russian and German, each object gets a gender. So tables, chairs, and so on all have to be masculine, feminine, or sometimes neuter. And we've been wondering whether talking about tables as masculine or feminine actually makes you think of them as more like males or more like females. And we're actually finding that that's true. So we've compared Spanish and German speakers, for example, and German speakers think toasters are more like boys, and Spanish speakers think toasters are more like girls.
How could you find that out, that they would think that way? What sort of questions do you ask them to discover
that? One kind of thing we can do is just show people pictures of an object and then a picture of a male or a female and ask them how similar are these two pictures. And in those kinds of tasks, we find speakers of Spanish and German will actually rate tables more similar to males or females, depending on how tables are talked about in their language. So if they're masculine, they'll be more similar to males. Another way we've done this is to ask Spanish and German speakers to describe objects. So we just ask them, tell us some adjectives to describe a table or a key or a bridge. And we find they say completely different things when asked to give these descriptions. For example, asked to describe a bridge, which is feminine in German and masculine in Spanish, German speakers will say things like beautiful, extended, elegant, and so on. Whereas Spanish speakers will say strong, sturdy, long, towering, and so on.
In the case of, well, French, I'm thinking of the French word for the sea, which is a feminine word. Is it the case that the French speaker, because he or she has been trained in the language, thinks of it as feminine because that's the way he or she was taught? Or do you think there is something about the mindset of the French that automatically causes them to think of the sea as feminine and led to the development of, you know, that word as being a feminine?
Right. So language and culture always go hand in hand. People who grew up speaking different languages also grew up being in different cultures. And so it's really hard to tease apart which one is the causal factor. So one thing that we do in my lab is always to bring people in and teach them a new way of talking, to investigate whether just learning a new way of talking without all kinds of other cultural factors can change the way you think. So, for example, we can bring regular English speakers in, psychology students, and teach them say a made-up language like Gumbuzi, and we can tell them there's this oositive-supitive distinction in Gumbuzi, which of course we also make up, and then we tell them some things are preceded by oos, some things are preceded by su, and later we can test them on all exactly the same tasks as we tested Spanish and German speakers, and we find the same effects. So they'll describe tables differently if they've learned that they're grammatically masculine or feminine in this made-up language, and they'll rate similarities between pictures differently and so on.
So in the language that they've adopted, if the gender is different from the language that they speak for the particular object, they change over when they're speaking the other language.
We've only tested English speakers so far in these kinds of tasks, and English doesn't have grammatical gender.
Yeah.
So they're starting out neutral. But what we have done is we've looked at people who speak both Spanish and German, and we've seen what happens to them on these objects that have opposite genders in the two languages. And it turns out that it's just a function of which language you speak better. So whichever language you speak better, that's the language that you're going to most likely think in.
Okay, and probably if it's the language you speak better, it's going to be your native language. Probably,
that's,
for most people.
Yeah, that's often true, but not always. Sometimes people grow up in a country and then get moved early in life. And for example, for me, English is a better language than Russian, even though Russian is my native language.
Have you analyzed for yourself how you think based on the fact that you knew Russian first and then you learned English later?
Sure. A lot of the insights come from just being bilingual and thinking about these things on my own. In fact, these questions of whether or not language shapes thought tend to be very obvious to people out in the world who speak more than one language. You ask any bilingual and they say, of course language shapes thought. I think completely differently in my two languages. But it's been very hard to prove scientifically. And so a lot of the inspiration for these studies comes from just observing myself and thinking, well, what are the most important differences? And what was the hardest thing to learn when learning English? Things like that.
Well, how do you think differently from one language to another?
Well, it's hard to say. There are lots of confounding factors for me because I was younger when I spoke Russian and I'm older now that I speak English. But certainly, let me give you one example. In Russian, all objects get to be he or she, more or less. And so when you talk about animals, you have to call them he or she. And when I switch to English, I have to call animals it, which seems to me really inhumane. When I switch from English to Russian, on the other hand, it seems silly to call tables he or she, because that seems to be glorifying them to some kind of human status. So it does take a cognitive shift to go between the two languages.
And you find yourself, when you're thinking, well, this is a question people ask a lot, and I'm going to ask you. They say, you know, if you know a couple of languages and you're just thinking something, what language are you thinking in? So let me ask you, what language do you think in?
I think in whichever language is most convenient for the purpose. So when I'm talking about, say, home or things relating to my parents, because I speak to them in Russian, I also tend to think in Russian. But when I'm thinking about work, then I tend to think in English because I don't know a lot of the words in Russian for the things I do at work.
Do you think someone can be truly bilingual given the fact that that different languages might require a different mindset?
That's a really interesting question. There have been studies done on people who speak two languages completely perfectly and just can't be told apart in any way, except in some very, very subtle linguistic tests. And the only way to predict which language they're going to be dominant in on those very, very subtle tests was to ask people, and this is completely wild, you have to ask, if you were to have one language cut out, which one would you want to keep? And it's the one that they want to keep that predicts kind of what is their dominant language only in the very tiniest tasks.
If someone does speak two or more languages, how has their way of thinking been changed?
Well, it depends on what kinds of languages they are and how they differ from one another. If your native language is one that makes lots of different distinctions and encodes lots of stuff, then learning other languages may not change the way you think. But often, any other language you learn is going to make other different kinds of distinctions. And so what we're trying to figure out now is whether learning a new language actually changes your underlying thinking patterns, or whether it just allows you to think differently when you're speaking that language. So what we're trying to figure out, basically, is when you become bilingual, does your thinking change permanently, or only for when you're speaking one language versus another?
You're studying that now, as you said, but do you have any early indications?
Sure. In the studies with Mandarin speakers in time, for example, that we talked about at the start, we found that Mandarin speakers will think about time vertically even when they're thinking for English. So even when we're testing them in English, they'll still show a Mandarin way of thinking about time. So there it seems like the language that they're being tested in is not so important. Also in the Spanish and German speaker studies on grammatical gender, we found that whether or not you think a table is masculine or feminine does not depend on what language you're tested in, because we test everyone in English. So it's likely to affect your underlying representation. But those are just the first couple of studies, and I'm sure lots of other things are there still to be found out.
Laura Boroditsky is my guest, an assistant professor at MIT. She is studying the cognitive processes of the brain and how people think, and whether the way we think differs with the language that we speak. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. It's the Todd Mundt Show on NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, celebrating its 75th anniversary of investing in communities and strengthening people, on the web at mott.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. And Rockefeller Brothers Fund, providing support for NPR cultural programming through a Charles E. Culpepper Endowment Grant.
I'm Todd Mundt, and Laura Boroditsky is my guest. We are talking about the cognitive processes of the brain and perhaps the different ways in which we think, depending on the language which we speak. There has been a lot of interest in this field, but there's also been some controversy, too. Some people think that there is an implication in this research that some cultures might be superior to others. What are your thoughts on that?
So far, all of our research has just shown how incredibly flexible people are in how they think. So you teach people a new way of talking, and they actually learn a new way of thinking. You could make arguments one way or another with bad implications. So, for example, you might say, look, showing that people who speak different languages think differently means that some cultures are better than others. On the other hand, if you went exactly the other way and you say, actually, your environment doesn't at all shape how you think, it's just all genetic. Well, that could lead to even worse implications, right? Then you could say, well, populations that have different genes could be superior or inferior to one another. If you have bad intentions, you can misinterpret science any which way. So far, all the evidence is just showing how incredibly flexible and adaptable people are.
Yeah, in fact, it just struck me now that there's almost someone could make almost a biodiversity argument for language, that the more speakers from different cultures there are of that language who have learned it perhaps as a second language, I mean, a language becomes more vibrant and rich, and a culture, one could argue, would become more vibrant and rich the more different kinds of speakers there are of that particular language.
Absolutely. In fact, it happens even within one person. The more cultures and languages you're exposed to, the more different ways you have of thinking. One thing that we've been finding in some studies we've been doing is that learning a new language can actually change the way you speak your first language. So if you learn a language that makes a new distinction, you actually start including that information in your native language as well, whereas other speakers of your language who don't speak the second language that you've learned will not include that information. So your first language actually becomes richer.
Could you give me an example of how that might work?
Sure. Let me give you one small example. We've been looking at Indonesian speakers and comparing them with English speakers. Indonesian doesn't include tense. So, for example, when I give you the example of the elephant ate the peanuts, you don't have to say ate in Indonesian. You just say eat. And verbs in general just can't change from a tense to tense, so to indicate future or past. Whereas in English, of course, we have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're finding is Indonesians who learn English start speaking Indonesian differently. So they won't just say the elephant eat the peanuts. They'll say the elephant already eat the peanuts, or the elephant soon eat the peanuts, things like that. These are very rough translations from Indonesian that I'm giving you. So they're actually starting to include new information in their descriptions of events in Indonesian that are different from monolingual Indonesian speakers.
Right. The information that they've learned in that other language is particularly important to include in that language. They sort of bring with them as baggage over to their native language.
Indeed.
Does this have any potential, this work that you are doing, to alter the way we understand how language formed in the first place?
It's very hard to speculate about that because it's very hard to do experiments. So all we can do really is tell stories. What we are finding out is that it's really inventions in thinking that lead developments in language. So if you learn to think a new way, then you might want to describe that new way of thinking to other people who speak your language. And so you invent new ways of talking. And those new ways of talking can get codified into language. And then the next generation of people who grew up speaking your language basically get your insights for free because they're just coded into the language and they have to learn them. And so I think one of the implications of this research is that languages are one of the things that make us as smart and sophisticated as we are, because we keep inventing new ways of talking, which bring with them new ways of thinking. And languages are a terrific way of spreading new insights across large populations.
And it comes back to something you said earlier about the adaptability and the flexibility of languages.
Indeed.
Some of the criticism that, or some of the, I guess, the concerns that critics raise about this, coming back to this idea of a superiority of culture over another, has to do with the fact that that others have tried to do this in the past. Benjamin Whorf is someone I've read about. There are probably others who have done that as well. If I understand correctly, he studied the Hopi Indians and made a number of assumptions that I think since then we have come to consider racist, at least, about the quality of thinking of the Hopi people.
Right. He was actually, so Whorf and Sapir, his mentor, were incredibly impressed by linguistic diversity. So they're some of the first people to really pay attention to how much languages differ from one another. What they didn't do is they didn't do experiments. So Whorf had never met a Hopi in his life. So he made a lot of theories based on what he read about Hopi linguistics, and some of those things were incorrect. So certainly people have made a lot of claims that have been bad in the past. But what we're starting to do now is figure out how you can actually do experiments to try to test these things. And one of the reasons it's taken so long is it's really hard to do these experiments right, so that you're giving each culture and each language an equal chance to show all its abilities, but at the same time, capturing the important difference. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's making this research easier is that you can test bilinguals these days. And bilinguals are an incredibly important source of information for finding out how speaking a language affects how you think. And so the more bilinguals we have, the easier it'll be to tease apart these effects.
You said that one of the hardest bits of this work is constructing the tests. I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about how you construct the tests that you're going to make.
Sure. So there are basically two fundamental problems. One is, suppose you want to test two different populations of people who speak different languages. Well, if you just take monolinguals and test them in their own native languages, you'll have a problem because you have to translate your task from one language to the other. And anyone who studied translation will tell you that it's impossible. It's impossible to translate things perfectly. So what you'll end up with is actually two very different tasks. And then if people perform differently, well, you can say no wonder people perform differently. You just you don't know that you gave the same task to the two groups. The other problem is one we discussed earlier about the close correlation between language and culture. So people who grew up speaking different languages also grew up in different cultures. So how do you tease apart the different influences? Is it language or is it culture that's important? So one of the things that we've done in my lab is instead of testing people who speak, who are monolinguals in two different languages, actually test bilinguals. So we can test two different language groups in the same language. That solves the problem of translating tasks across languages. The other innovation that we have is we bring people in and teach them new ways of thinking about, new ways of talking about things. So that gets rid of the culture confound. If you can teach people just a new way of talking, and that changes how they think, that means we can establish a causal relationship between how you talk and how you think about something. So those are some of the most important innovations that I think have happened in the last few years.
Do you find that people who are bilingual are generally aware to a certain extent that they think differently from language to language?
Some people are. It really varies from person to person. The easiest way to find out the most important differences between two languages is just to ask someone who has had to learn one language starting from another. Ask them, what were the hardest things to figure out? And they'll tell you, and those will be the most important, most salient differences.
I know people who will say, well, I can't do this particular thing in this language, or I can do this one, or I prefer to read this particular book in that language, in its original language, rather than the translation. That there's a sense that some things work better in some languages than in others.
Absolutely. So one of the classic examples, going back to the issue of grammatical gender, one of the classic examples is in poetry translation. Some poems will take an object and personify it. And if you're translating from one language where that object is masculine, grammatically masculine, and you want to translate it into a language where the object is now grammatically feminine, the whole meaning of the poem changes. You simply can't translate the poem so that it has even remotely the same meaning if the grammatical genders change, because gender is such an important social construct for us. And so that's actually where some of the first claims about this and grammatical gender were made, is in poetry translation.
Sure, the translator's struggling, I bet, with a tremendously difficult job.
In fact, most people who write about translation write about how it's absolutely impossible. So.
Yeah. And maybe that says something about the mindsets that, you can move from one to another to a certain extent, but many things can't be transmitted. They just are, I guess. You can't transmit certain meanings from one language to another.
Indeed. One example that I like, it's an analogy. Translating from one language to another is kind of like translating from one sport to another. So what's the equivalent of a shortstop, for example, in American football? There isn't one. You just can't come up with one. And some words are exactly like that. You can't take one word in one language and translate it to another.
Well, Laura Boroditsky, thank you for taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you very much.
Laura Boroditsky, a professor at MIT.